the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. Joining me this week is our very special guest is Ben Tuff, Chief Product Officer at UM Worldwide. How are you, Ben?
I'm good, thank you very much. It's pushing the end of the day here in Singapore, but it looks like it's raining for me to make the run to the car.
Oh, well, we're delighted to have you with us while you are here at the end of the day. And also glad to be joined by ExchangeWire CSO, Kieran O'Kane. How are you, Kieran?
I'm very well, Chris. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. I'm at the tail end of a cold, so if I sound a bit unusual, that's why.
I think you sound great.
Oh, thank you, Kieran.
BBC quality journalism there.
It's the affirmation I needed.
That's it.
Very glad. Very glad to hear that. We'll get started with our coverage of the three news stories of the week, as we always do. Starting with, Google has announced an AI chatbot, Bard, to rival the wildly popular ChatGPT. The program, which is built on the tech giant's Lambda conversational technology, is currently being tested by a select group of users, with plans to be made available to the public in a matter of weeks. The announcement came just a day before Microsoft unveiled a new version of search engine Bing that incorporates ChatGPT. The big tech firm has agreed to invest billions of dollars into OpenAI, the company behind the chatbot, causing speculation that they would integrate the technology into Bing's search function. So, big story here, two tech giants launching or innovating with rival offerings in a nascent but very exciting field. My first question really with this story is, have we reached a point, or are we at a point where we're seeing a fundamental shift in search and the nature of search? Kieran, what do you think?
I think we are, but I think we're sort of at the gimmicky stage. And that's always, I have a sort of like a benchmark for that when you have like mediocre types on LinkedIn just talk about ChatGPT, you know that we're still at the gimmicky look at me. I'm just expecting the ChatGPT consultant to pop up at some stage in our industry. Guns for Hire, who'll help you write ChatGPT text prompts. I guarantee it, €100 an hour, whatever the fuck they're going to charge us. Ben's going to allude to Google's massive cock-up just yesterday over like producing wrong answers. I think we're sort of at this early doors piece where they're getting the technology right. The early signs are it's going to be a transformational technology in the sense of how we might use a search engine. I think that has huge implications for Google's ad business, which I guess is the class. Some people talk as it's the classic innovator's dilemma, isn't it? Like the Google search business is worth $160 billion a year. It's absolute like cash volcano, as people call it, or it's just a pile of cash that Google have on hand every year from one business solution, and it had. This technology could have an impact on that because, we're asking questions of AI, which is basically using many different sources of information to bring together a two-sentence answer or a 500-word answer. And the implications of that are huge because then you can't serve specific ads along that. So it affects many, many things. First and foremost, the advertising business, and also maybe even traffic to the open web. It means that like you're more likely to just take the answer and use that as opposed to like clicking the five or six different outputs that Google give you. So I think it has huge implications. I think we're still at early doors. It does have like this type of technology is going to have a profound effect in our industry, I think. Even from a search point of view, it sort of has knock-on effects, sort of the traffic to other sites, but also then how we use this technology in our day-to-day, right? At the at the agency level, at the creative agency level, at the execution level, at sort of bid optimization, trading across the various walled gardens and DSPs. So yeah, I'm excited by this technology. I think it's good. But at the minute, it just feels it's like everybody is playing around with it. Google's response to Microsoft is sort of a knee jerk, and probably they didn't want to roll it out yet until they figured it out. And Ben can now talk about the mess up yesterday the name is crap as well. Also, ChatGPT is too complicated. You need to kind of like get snappier names, I think. The Bard, maybe a reference to the great man himself, Willie Shakespeare. I'm not really sure. Was asked a specific answer in Google's actually promotional video, and it was wrong. So you can see, Grace, that all these models or machine learning models are only as good as the data they ingest. And I think that's going to be a problem that both Microsoft and Google and Amazon and Facebook and Twitter or whoever used this technology will have to actually source proper data, verified data. And it makes me think that what have we been getting from Google for the last 25 years if the Bard is taking all this information and just spouting out lies to us?
A lot to digest there. Ben, what do you think?
It just kind of went...
And I think there are a couple of things. I mean, the thing with Google yesterday, it was obviously a massive face plant for them. I too question who was vetting the ads, because I would have just gone and checked the facts and made sure that if you're going to put an ad out, for goodness sake, get your basic media hygiene in place.
This is what happens with your in-house everything, Ben. You need an agency. That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. You need a very good media agency. I think, you know, in some ways, I also find it slightly reassuring, because it does send the message that this is not a perfect tech. And I think a lot of consumers will start to look at this almost straight away as like, this is new. This is really accurate. And it shows that actually be careful with it. And I think it's a very good kind of watch out whether it was really worth taking $100 billion off the value of Google in a day yesterday, which is what it did. I mean, that's fairly painful. I don't think that's a massive stock market overreaction. It also shows the market's misunderstanding of kind of what this technology ultimately means. And it's nascent and it's kind of innovative and it's going to take a long time to get right. You know, we play around with ChatGPT here as a piece of tech, and it's producing some interesting stuff, but I would leave it at that point of interesting stuff. You know, I don't really feel the need to have someone write my emails for me. Will it produce a really accurate media plan for me? No. The second kind of really big thing about all of this is in search, you tend to put in sort of a fairly simple thing like, which was the first telescope to take a photo of an exoplanet. Actually, Google sent them back a response from NASA, by the way, and it's NASA who are kind of half claiming that. So anyway, that parked. I think, you know, where kind of the AI ChatGPT thing works is obviously with a much more detailed query. The more information you give it, the better response back. And I think that does begin to change the future of what we're going to land up having to do with search. So if you're a brand and you're thinking about, how do we set up SEM, SEO kind of capabilities? You've got to start moving away from people putting in, I don't know, Volkswagen or Audi. You know, they're going to be looking for, I need a car that is really, really reliable and is going to be able to get me from here to here on a single charge, because let's assume it's going to be electric, and it's great for a family of four and has a really good kind of safety record and breakdown history. And then that is going to spew back, the car that you're looking for is this. And I think that becomes really exciting, but also probably quite scary from a branding perspective.
But does that mean that the problem with that is where does the machine learning model get that specific data from, right?
So does that mean that Google start creating their own content, don't they? So that drives the content conversation.
But does that give this is really interesting, because like we're getting into like the weeds, the second and third order effects of this.
Yeah.
Does that mean that Google would have to state the sources they have in terms of, you know, when you say I'm looking for an electric vehicle with this specs, right? Would Google have to reference the specific data points they use to get that aggregate that answer? And does that mean then that those particular sites will actually get value from your clients because they have authority and they have respectability, and actually they can then charge a premium I can see a whole new model around advertising. So the idea of brand.
I think you're right.
Get into the weeds. Sorry, right. This is actually really interesting.
But I think you're right. You know, it's if you're writing an academic paper, you have to validate where stuff comes from. If it's just come from some, I don't know, random thing that, and again, what was it? Adrian Charles is going on in the Guardian today about a friend of his who's got a take on, and it's the heating's broken. You know, is that a valid source? No, probably not. But I think it kind of needs to be declared where sort of those points of evidence have come from. And I think actually, you know, Kieran, you make a really, really important point. Those sources then become much more valuable, and they become really valuable as media touch points.
Exactly.
But the content creation piece that then works with kind of an API solution is also then even more valuable. And I think that becomes a very rich kind of opportunity area.
So this is really, really interesting. So everybody was worrying, particularly publishers worrying about the traffic they get from how do you do this and how do you do that? The how to things that ChatGPT will just commoditize all that and the traffic won't go there. But this very point about authoritative sites or sites with sort of proper status that Google and Microsoft are referencing, because the idea is that it's very clear that Google have a very powerful technology here, right? Regardless of what Bard does, right? But again, I say it's only as good as the data that informs the model, right?
Absolutely.
So my view is the next SEM or SEO sort of evolution will be looking to get authoritative sites into Google's sort of it'll be like Google will vet these for specific authority, how long have they been doing, how respectable the journalists, how reliable are they, what fact checking to do. And I actually think in a way, this could be a very, very interesting sort of evolution of search in a good way, because then it kind of forces Google and Microsoft to vet the proper premium sites versus the dog shit, middle of the road, long tail stuff.
But take it to the next place.
Yeah.
So yes, absolutely, it does that. But then you get into paid advertising. So you are paying to have your response go into the answers as you get paid ads at the moment. We're going to be back into that kind of piece we've got at the moment where that top search ranking has got an ad against it. So those sources,
I think that's fair enough. Right? So if you think about Google's model, I think this is I do think this is existential to Google's 160 billion cash pot, right? For Microsoft, right, who make a couple of billion off Bing, they don't really care, right? If they get a really good technology, and to be honest, if Bing was spitting out those answers, you're in holiday, right, and you haven't really done any research that most people don't do, and you say, I'm on holiday here in this town in Italy, what's the best pizza restaurant? And Microsoft could go to a TripAdvisor or a booking.com with real authority and just aggregate that and then spit that out. But that one position at the top or one position at the bottom of that would have incredible value, right? And it would be an auction-based thing. So they could make a fortune. Whereas Google is basically just plastering ads across their entire... The search experience in Google is horrendous, versus what it used to be. It's just ads. They're trying to make as much money. And I think that this... does change the nature of the search experience and the revenue model. So we may flip then to brands spending more money with brand publishers, premium publishers, because they have authority, because they appear in those ChatGPT or Bard outputs. And it actually, it kind of just reallocates spend. I'm excited with this. This takes power away from Google. And I think this is why Google's in a panic, because they've thought through the process. They call it red alert, right? And I actually think this is brilliant to have this conversation, because it actually makes me think about it. But you work through the process, Google says, shit, this has got real implications for our cash cow, right?
Absolutely.
Might not be.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you and I are thinking about it, there's no way that they've not.
We're not as smart as them.
Exactly. No, we're not. Let's face it. No, I think it's true. And I think that does become really interesting. I think it does start shifting the revenue into a different place, and it moves away from you know, how much money do you put behind search? It also changes. And look, we look at things through the funnel and through the marketing funnel. It probably elevates kind of some of this, the role of search up the funnel, as well as to further to the bottom of the funnel.
What do you mean by that?
It's got a, well, if you think about sort of the way we look at kind of the way in which media touch points work, you know, things like TV, digital out of home, very good for driving awareness consideration. Obviously, a lot of programmatic, you know, very good for driving kind of conversion at that kind of purchase piece. Search tends to sit in a particular kind of, I'm searching for something and finding out more information. That's still going to sit there. But I think if you think about it, search could move from just providing a series of different links to different sources. It's going to provide an opinion piece, and that's going to be a consideration driver. But also, it could more rapidly move people through that kind of purchase funnel and accelerate them out the bottom. It may sort of almost negate the need for some of that kind of Google Ads service as well. So actually, it works all the way through in that way. So I think actually, you know, it is a challenge to their business. They're going to have to think about it.
Yeah. Sorry, Grace, totally hijacked our conversation. Apologies.
No, not at all. I mean, it's such an interesting conversation that I'm reluctant to break it up.
One last thing, though, on that point, though, Ben, all the stuff that Google used to make money, like brand, buying your own brand keywords, that kind of goes out the window, doesn't it? Like brands, it could literally loosen up so much money spend for other things. Like you were talking about content marketing. I think they could shift a ton of money into that because it actually would add value to their what do I call it? It's not SEO. I guess it is SEO, but like, we'll have to have a new phrase for it.
Yeah, you're optimizing for AI search, aren't you? So that's what you're doing. But no, I completely agree. You know, you don't have to kind of keep buying your own keywords and competitors buying your brand name as a keyword, which is a race to the bottom and a vast suck for cash. And, you know, frankly, the people who benefit are Google. I don't think the brands benefit from it. Really significantly. I think this puts the power back more into the hands of brands and brand owners
and publishers.
Agencies and publishers. I think it's great. I think it's really good. I think it'll be really exciting.
Yes, we're all positive with that one, Race.
Yeah. Definitely a great note to finish the discussion on. And I mean, we could have the whole episode carry on that discussion. It's great, but we do have a couple of other stories to cover. So
Ben's just gave me my idea for the Mad Tech sketch next week. So that's really good. Thank you, Ben.
Fabulous. Very You're helping good. On the content side.
I will send my bill.
Yes, please do send that along with the audio. I will move us on to our next story, which is that Tencent has forged new partnerships with Singaporean companies to expand its presence in the country. The tech giant has united with regional ride-hailing app Grab through its WeChat app, which provides social media and instant messaging services and access a digital wallet. The deal reportedly applies both to the domestic Chinese, I believe it's pronounced Weixin, I may have that wrong, apologies if I do,
yep.
And the international WeChat versions of the app, which Tencent claims have over 1.3 billion monthly users. Last December, Grab launched a mini program via Weixin, which lets users book services across 480 Southeast Asian cities without having to download Grab separately. It allows Chinese users to pay for purchases in Chinese yuan using Weixin or WeChat Pay. The company is betting on the uptick in Chinese tourists to Singapore, as is Weixin, which is partnering with the Singapore Tourism Board on a new program targeting Chinese travellers. So my first question really with this story is, why do Tencent kind of have their eyes on Singapore? What does it offer the company? And Ben, I'll come to you on this one first.
Yeah, I mean, look, in some ways, I'm quite surprised by this as a story, because I thought this was already happening. I mean, if you walk into a lot of different places, there are QR codes to pay with kind of WeChat Pay. And I guess this is focused more on the Chinese consumers. As China opens up, and trying to get a flight to or from China to Singapore at the moment is really hard or really expensive. You know, Singapore is a big destination. It's a shopping destination. It's currently winter in large chunks of China. And, you know, Singapore has always been a big destination for shopping and also as a gateway to other places. And it becomes a great testing ground. I think, you know, it's a relatively small place to test something. And if you can get it working here, you then find the proper approach in which you can roll that out to lots of other markets. So, you know, honestly, I expect to see this across the UK, across the US as soon as, you know, by the end of the year. I don't think it's radically different. The thing I think we have to understand is that Weixin, you know, is the internet in many ways for China. Baidu is the search engine in China, but really it doesn't exist in the way that Google does. All search, all activity really tends to, you know, hotel bookings, flight bookings, everything takes place within Weixin, which is a great way for understanding and joining up what your consumer is doing and getting a great understanding of first party data, you know, putting aside any of the kind of concerns around that. And, you know, Chinese consumers have been in China for 3 years, and that is what they are used to. And of course, coming to a major market like Singapore, you know, if you want to benefit from the Chinese yuan, Chinese dollar, you've got to now think about how do they purchase. It's the same as when China first started opening up and tourism really took off. UnionPay had to be seen everywhere because that was the way in which Chinese consumers pay. They don't have Visa and MasterCard. They're not using that at home in China in the same way. And it is just making sure that you respect the way in which one of your biggest tourist target markets is going to want to pay, and it feels like they can at home. And even if I go back pre-pandemic, my last trip to Shanghai, I went out to a restaurant with a friend, and I said, like, sorry, I'll pay. I pulled out my credit card and they looked at me as if I was mad, and they just produced a QR code, you know. So, and they are going to, if taxi drivers here, shops here, they're all going to get that crazy look, because it's like, I mean, I've not used cash in years. I use a credit card on my phone. But for a lot of Chinese consumers, they're not looking at it that way. They're paying through their Weixin kind of app, and now they're doing it in sort of, yeah, in Weixin. They're using it in WeChat. I don't feel that it's kind of game changing. I could, you know, WeChat is still very specific to China and Chinese consumers. Those of us that are doing business or have got friends in China have WeChat on our phones. I don't see it suddenly becoming something that everyone in the UK or everyone in France or everyone in kind of Australia is going to suddenly have on their phone, and they're going to start paying that way. But it is going to be an onward progression towards that kind of cashless society, and probably a move away from, I guess, also, you know, hard currencies, probably into kind of more Bitcoin kind of cryptocurrencies as they move forward, because China has made a very clear piece that they want to have a state's cryptocurrency that is national currency. So it's going to be all about how they join that together. And then obviously, if you're coming into another market, oh, I've got the China crypto thing and I've not got yuan, but it doesn't matter because it will do the automatic kind of translation within the app between the two currencies. I think that's how I see it. You know, Singapore, as I say, is already incredibly cashless. As I say, I haven't used cash, I don't think, for 2 years at least. And everything is done by swiping phones, swiping cards. And Alipay and WeChat have had QR codes around here since pre-pandemic anyway. So yeah, it's just consolidating and just making it easier for Chinese consumers coming in.
Kieran, what do you make of this?
I suppose it sort of feeds into that move towards, you know, not using cash on a day-to-day basis. I mean, the WeChat thing, I can understand. They're obviously looking to broaden their market. There's a lot of Chinese tourists. I just don't see everybody using WeChat because of very, very obvious reasons in Western countries. I don't think most people, if TikTok is about to be banned potentially, what chance is WeChat getting any market share when there's such negative views? And I think Westerners have a different view. I think they're more comfortable using multiple apps. I think in their heads, using one app is, I think it's ingrained in people now, like that this type of thing is not good to have power. Meta would love to do this. They would love to own the whole purchase funnel, but I think that people just don't use it that way. I think people are comfortable using multiple apps, which is good. It's interesting. We're doing a Web3 content hub, and it feeds into this conversation, I guess. Ben was talking about, it's like, you know, the rise of sort of QR codes and NFTs. You can see how they're going to be used by brands in the future in terms of like loyalty and all the rest of it. So, I mean, this is just an example of specific digital wallet. That is a big problem though. Like, what do you use to contain it? So a MetaMask is a fairly niche digital wallet, which contains your coins and your NFTs, but it hasn't got mass appeal. So I think some of these, I could see you know, an Amazon or a Meta or a Google or an Apple launching something similar and sort of like following this path as well. I mean, I always think that Singapore, when you go to the city, it's so advanced in many of these things. I agree with Ben. I didn't use any cash that was there at all. It was just all cashless. So, yeah, look, taking out the fact that WeChat is doing this, I think it's a model of how things will develop in other markets. And it's pretty exciting. Like, you know, this all feeds into our own stuff about identity, right? Could you use a wallet as an ID and be comfortable with brands, work with brands directly? Again, it goes back to like avoiding the road tax of Meta, Amazon, and Google. If you have that direct relationship with a client, with a user, that's very, very interesting to brands. So as a story about, you know, the progression of how consumers interact with a day-to-day utility and brands themselves, I think it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think this is also a move forward. I'm thinking about Grab sort of building their mini program. It's a way of, in Singapore, protecting themselves against, say, Gojek, who are the other kind of ride-hailing app here. We don't have Uber. You know, embedding yourself within the app, if you get any kind of monopoly position on that, you know, when do Deliveroo do that? If you're kind of wanting to get food delivered, you know, what are the other ones that kind of go in there? And it gives them some advantage. I think the only thing that's really interesting to me is that Grab in itself is obviously one of these super apps that exists in this part of the world. And Grab has its own pay system within its own app. So yes, I get why they put themselves into the Weixin app, because you're after Chinese consumers. But you don't want everyone then jumping into WeChat. And, you know,
no,
it's big here in Singapore, relatively speaking. You want people to be using Grab to then start using Grab to use GrabPay to pay for stuff.
It is an odd one. If there are two super apps, competing super apps, it's just odd that they're working together. Maybe it's just that they want, there's a large Chinese community and traveling community, and it's just as a means to access them. Maybe that's the way it is. I think it's a partner of convenience, if anything.
Yeah, it is absolutely a partnership of convenience. Tencent didn't really have any. I don't think they have an ownership of Grab. So I don't think that really makes a logical, you know, it doesn't make a logical link that way either. But it is. It's just Tencent sort of flexing their muscles a bit, making sure that they're ahead of the game, and that, you know, again, how can they then sell that data maybe back to their airline partners, for instance? Well, we know we sold them this ticket. This is what they then did. So therefore, this is the kind of stuff they're interested in. So we can then start targeting with this kind of content, this kind of advertising, and therefore then Weixin, you know, this is what they can then sell to their other partners, sort of as a, you know, it's a CDP, isn't it? You know, you get more information. You don't just understand what Chinese consumers are doing in China, but you're beginning to get an understanding of what they're spending outside of China.
Interesting stuff. I'll leave that discussion there. I'll move us rapidly along to our third story of the week, which is that a US judge has rejected an appeal by the Federal Trade Commission to prevent Meta from acquiring Within Unlimited. The FTC had argued that the tech giant's plans to purchase the virtual reality app maker was anti-competitive because it would narrow the still-growing market. However, San Jose judge Edward Davila denied the authorities' request for an injunction against the merger, saying that Meta would have struggled to build a VR fitness app to compete with Within's Supernatural. The outcome is a significant win for Meta, both because the company has been under intense regulatory scrutiny for several years and because it means that this strategically important acquisition can go ahead. However, Judge Davila deemed the premise of the FTC's complaint that the merger would stifle competition, or could stifle competition, also referred to as actual potential competition, valid, setting what some commentators consider an important precedent for future FTC antitrust investigations. So the premise of the judge's ruling is that Meta don't have the resources to build a kind of VR fitness app, and therefore, you know, acquiring Within Unlimited, and their own fitness app Supernatural is, you know, justified or is not anti-competitive. Does that ruling surprise you at all? Are you taken aback by this outcome? What do you think, Kieran?
I mean, I've never been in the metaverse, Facebook metaverse. Am I surprised? But I mean, look, the way I look at it, let Meta waste money if they want to. I mean, this is nonsense. I think the probably is it's an overreaction, I think, to a company who wants to own a whole space. And the reality is that the Meta can't own the metaverse, if that's what you want to call it. It's just impossible. There's too many players. First of all, they haven't really got the rails that Google and Apple have in terms of like the actual hardware to make it work. And most people's first interaction will be through AR, not VR, and mixed reality. Doesn't matter that Meta has a fitness app in the metaverse. No, I don't understand why this is. I don't understand why they blocked this in the first place. It's really the DOJ is kind of like, you know, or the FTC is, and seems to be probably a little bit bored, right? Maybe they should think about breaking up Google and Amazon and Meta and Google instead of like blocking silly minor things. I suppose their argument is we don't want Meta to have another foothold or do a land grab in a new area. But the problem is the area hasn't been defined yet. Like it's very early days, and maybe most of us, even the Gen Zs and the younger kids, want to live their entire lives under a bloody helmet, right? We are human beings. I keep telling people this: you can't rewire our DNA, right? We're barely out of the trees a couple of thousand years. We're evolving as a species, but we're still very social, right? People still need human interaction. It's embedded in us. Like, so putting on a bloody helmet, it's not going to help you. Just get down to the pub and have a few pints of people, or actually go meet some people or join a play group or a book group and make friends. That's my advice to you listeners. So this story, should the alarm bells be ringing? No, because bloody Facebook/Meta is burning £14 billion a year trying to realize this dream. And, you know, Zuckerberg was on a call recently and he said he's not doing as much. He's talking about AI and the stock price went up. So that tells you where the market forces are. I just don't see how this is should be like a pressing case. There are bigger things to be looking at in sort of the anti-competitive space. That's my own opinion, not the opinion of Exchange Wire or its amazing content people.
Thank you for making that explicit to listeners.
a virtual beer, come on. It's a real beer.
It's just ridiculous.
Agree. Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, what I find is that what's the line that he says that they wouldn't be able to do that, but they're spending $10 billion a year on the metaverse. I'm like, God, what could you do with $10 billion? But they can't create this and they've got to go and buy it. Obviously, someone's felt that kind of virtual gyms and virtual fitness is the way forward. I would kind of point them in the direction of Peloton quite rapidly and say, be careful. Is that really the way to go? I mean, does it surprise me? I should think the judge is sort of going, why am I looking at this? It's fairly small fry in the scheme of things, but he's probably aware that, yeah, it could become big in the future. In fairness, Facebook have got some of their acquisitions done quite well. Instagram, WhatsApp have obviously become huge, and the European Trade Commission or whatever it is now is looking at that and, you know, talk about splitting it back up. You know, does the metaverse then get split up from that because they've got advantage? Does it stop someone else doing something in the metaverse? But Kieran and I completely agree. You know, Meta are not going to own the metaverse, and I am very much with Scott Galloway around the idea that the metaverse is probably more about listening, because to your point, Kieran, walking around with those, you know, with big headsets on all the time, you're going to bump into people. But with earphones on, you're less likely to bump into people. You know, you might be looking at your phone and still do it. But for me, the idea of sharing and being part of something is probably more of a listening experience rather than some virtual, slightly, and look, the graphics will improve, but a slightly dodgy graphical kind of experience. Because if you're somewhere in the office and someone says, hey, I'm in the metaverse doing this. Do you really want to put your headset on and join them? Is that really how it's going to work? I don't know. I'll be probably proven wrong in 5 years' time.
If we get to the point of technology like the holodeck and Star Trek, I think that's a different scenario, right? At the minute, it's pixelated, and I suppose this all goes back to AI as well, right? Those two sort of things overlap a little bit here, right? So, like,
There's a point to that. Taking that into
that's
an
entertainment.
That's entertainment, and you're on two different starships. Billions of miles apart, and you want to come together for a beer, and maybe the beer still tastes real, but that's a significantly different type of technology.
It's a total different, like what we're talking about here, right?
For Matt, you found a point to it. I still struggle up to a degree with a point on it, and I've got colleagues around here who would fundamentally disagree with that. So again, that is a Ben type of opinion.
I think that the likes of Fortnite and Epic are their own epic, their own sort of metaverse. I keep saying that to people, the virtual worlds that the gaming world has immersed in. It's obvious what Facebook should be buying. They should be buying Epic, but that will never happen. Not in a million years. Like, if a shitty little deal like this can't get done, then there's no way that's getting done. And to be honest, when I think about it, I agree with Ben, that they could build this in a heartbeat. I reckon it's probably Acquihire, the really talented people over there, engineers and the right, they probably want to get them into Meta and get them working on specific. But the problem is, what is the, when they launched Facebook, it was the exclusivity of it all, right? The Harvard.edu, hey, that was the email address that everybody wanted. That was the exclusivity. This is different. I feel that, what they're trying to do and what they're trying to achieve feels all wrong. It feels like someone that Apple would probably get ahead of them, because they have the hardware, they have the rails, and they have just a bit more nuance about building consumer technology, right? Apple have the most valuable segment of consumer in the world, right? The richest people buy Apple products. That's a fact, right? An absolute fact. So I think that's where you're going to see the real interesting sort of innovation. And I guess, Apple is just going to be a framework, and people will build their AR apps around the Apple ecosystem, right? And remember, Apple is not dependent on ads for revenue, which is what Facebook make or slash Meta. I can't even call it the Meta. It's what Facebook make most of their money from. So they're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. They've got an opportunity probably to build hardware, to build these sort of sticky apps, sticky experiences, but it's really shit. Nobody look, Netflix are basically rolling out a Peloton killer, right? And most people would prefer to sit in front of their TV screen and exercise. I think it's going to be very hard to get people to stick a helmet on them and sweat like a pig while they're working out with a bloody helmet on them. They'd be getting sick in it, and getting dizzy. I think that's it's all nonsensical. It doesn't make any sense at all. I do see that world evolving some shape or form, but there's probably more to do with B2B stuff. Like, you can imagine surgeons and sort of working together on virtual scenarios, or even surgery, people taking place or taking part of that. So I don't know. I mean, he's got the money. So he's trying to throw shit at the wall and see what sticks. I think that's what we're dealing with here at the minute.
Yeah, and I agree, but I think, again, you're hitting a kind of quite important point there. The surgeon kind of piece works really well, because you can imagine, rather than calling, I've got this really complex operation, and then I want to have someone else in the room who's got some experience. You can have someone in 12-hour time zone away working on the same thing. That's an incredibly powerful practical application of kind of a metaverse kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's not consumer day-to-day stuff. I think the challenge that I've got is the Facebook... I'm not a big Instagram user, but the Facebook user experience is terrible. It's basically what it was 10 years ago, give or take. I don't feel like they've ever invested in it. It's just full of ads and posts from irrelevances that I'm not interested in. But Facebook Meta is not good at user experience. And to your point, Apple is brilliant on user experience. Oh, it has its flaws, but on user experience, design, all of that, they are, and they've got a gaming platform as well, and they are, in many ways, a much more appropriately set up business to deliver a solution like this.
Exactly. They have experience of building beautiful products that actually have utility, right? I feel if Facebook had spent that money on building a shopping thing and having an end-to-end play with it, they would make so much more money in this stupid crap. I feel like, you know, I need to reinvent this. And like maybe someone will listen back to this but in a couple of years and say, oh, you're full of crap. But I do think the problem with Facebook is it's a land grab they can't win because they don't own the rails. They don't build beautiful consumer products. And at the end of the day, you know, people care about what they wear and what they see, you know, and how they, you're not going to spend 4 hours under a bloody helmet. You know, you're not a Deliveroo driver or a delivery, you know, I mean, it's, you're not driving around in a bloody circuit on a motorcycle race. This is it's logic. And I think that's what the biggest problem. Look, it's R&D, it's innovation, the way they see it, but like, it's not logical. I think it's more likely that you're going to have those AR products built into your phone or your watch, and it'll be sort of like overlaid in your real world scenario. Like, that's where I think this will go. It looks like a pixelated Sinclair 40 or 68K, you know, from back in the day, like, you know, Horace the Spider. I know if you're old enough to remember Horace the Spider, like, literally pixelated. He was on a bloody pair of skis, and you press right and he'd find a tree. It feels a bit like that right now. Yeah. And I'm going, well, why would you be in that world when you could play in Fortnite, when you can immerse, like, if you're into Fortnite, and immerse yourself in this amazing sort of virtual world, which has its own digital currency, that has huge engagement and is gamified. You know,
I agree.
I mean, I would be surprised if Facebook start trying to buy gaming companies. I mean, that should really be their way in. They need a hook into this.
Well, they're saying the Activation Blizzard thing might fall through, so you never know.
But they'll never. In a million years, if that deal falls through, there's no way Meta will get it. Not a chance. It'd be blocked just because they're so toxic as a company.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, just blithering on, Grace. No, apologies. I mean,
stranger things have happened. You never know. We might have a future episode where we're discussing a potential Meta Activision takeover. Who knows? But we'll finish our discussion of the news of the week there. We'll leave it there and we'll move on to the second part of the podcast and talk to you a bit more, Ben, about what you're working on and what's going on at UM Worldwide. So, yeah, what are you guys focusing on? What's kind of taking up most of your attention at the minute and what are you most excited about?
Yeah, I've got a kind of total APAC focus. It's been a very, very busy start to the year for us here. There have been pitches coming in all over the place in all kinds of markets. I think obviously the challenge that we're looking at the moment is there going to be a consumer slowdown? Is there going to be a kind of a tightening of marketing and advertising budgets? Which categories is that going to take place in? But also, which ones are we going to see growth in? I think, you know, what's really kind of been exciting for us is that we've spent the last 4 years very much talking more about the principles of marketing and the importance of really great media planning and implementation. Because at the end of the day, you know, that is what we are as an agency, but it seems to be a skill that has been lost in a lot of areas. And it's something we've really focused on and, you know, we want to now double down on because we now see that as a huge opportunity. And it sounds really odd. But we are really excited about getting back to basics in terms of what we do really, really well as an agency. And to be honest, stop worrying so much about things like, you know, the metaverse and, oh, we've got to come up with NFT solutions and things like this. Because at the end of the day, the last 60 years have shown that the core principles of marketing have not changed. You know, the tools that you use to get the message in front of consumers have absolutely changed, and the way in which consumers engage with media have changed. But that's what we need to be dealing with, and that's the way in which we need to be thinking. And so, yeah, I think we're quite excited about sort of taking a number of our key clients sort of on that journey, and also sort of re-engaging with our core planning community in a really rich way and exciting them around the role that you're not just filling in an Excel spreadsheet, but you know what you're doing is driving the growth of the brands that you are working with. And in many ways, you should see yourselves as much of a guardian of the brand as the brand manager. So I think, you know, that's where we're trying to get to, and sort of rolling that out across different markets, working with the kind of the different nuances of China versus Thailand, Vietnam versus Singapore, Japan, Australia, you know, and India as well, of course. You know, that is a very exciting challenge for us. But I think, you know, it feels like we're on a real kind of accelerated growth journey about how do we drive the growth of our clients' businesses. And, you know, hopefully, you know, there's some hope, but also there's a skill to it, you know, winning new business and bringing those in to expand the portfolio out, because the more clients we've got, the more they all benefit from that kind of cross-vitalization and learning that we get.
I mean, thinking about challenges as well, you've kind of touched on them. Are there any kind of more unique challenges that have sprung up, you know, since maybe the start of this year or kind of the end of last year? And how are you kind of approaching those?
Another challenge that I think everyone's facing in our industry at the moment is just talent and bringing people in. You know, it's not a case that we've got lots of people resigning. We haven't. It's just that we are needing to do more recruitment and just finding the right people. Yeah, I think that, you know, the other challenge that really is, you know, that has kicked in, we've always been very data focused as an agency. You know, we do a lot of econometric modeling just as a part of what we do rather than as an add-on. But realizing that we need to rapidly engage a new group of people within our business around how do you interpret those models? What does it mean for planning? What does it mean for measurement? And what's the difference between getting kind of a short-term hit versus a long-term gain, and sort of bring some of those principles in? So that, you know, those are, in some ways, they're new challenges, but they're also age-old challenges that just never seem to go away.
And what are you kind of looking forward to as the year progresses? Are there kind of any things, you know, specific in the calendar that you know are coming up that you're particularly looking forward or working towards?
No, and we've got a big pitch. We have also just got a new global CEO coming in, Sasha Savic. He joined us on Monday. You know, he will, I'm quite sure, bring a new energy to the business. So I'm really excited to see what he's going to bring and how sort of, you know, his thinking can be interpreted and impacted from an APAC perspective, but also how, you know, we will continue. And certainly, I hope, you know, June, we have a global kind of get together. You know, we are able to showcase a lot of the work we've done in APAC and actually how that can then impact our global markets in terms of some of those solutions. You know, we talk here about moving at the speed of Asia. It is incredibly fast. It is a lot faster than the rest of the world. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, the Tencent Weixin kind of WeChat kind of thing. You know, that is being piloted here, but expect to see it in the rest of the world very, very soon. And that is kind of how we look at a lot of the stuff here. That kind of growth around actually getting back to the fundamentals of core marketing and media planning is, in a lot of ways, it is starting again in this part of the world as markets like Indonesia and the Philippines are saying, hold on a minute, we've got to stop throwing mud at walls. We've got to actually do, you know, to do this better. And the kind of other clients or potential clients are beginning to follow what we've been doing with our clients for the past 4 or 5 years. So I think, you know, they're really exciting things.
Excellent. That's really, really great stuff. Thank you so much, Ben, for telling us more about what you're working on and for joining us for the discussion of the new stories. It was great to have you.
Yeah, it was cool. Thank you very much for the time. Love the conversation, Kieran. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, I'll definitely will have another conversation with that search implication. I think that has, like, I believe there'll be panels in this, because if Microsoft were smart, they would definitely build that product straight away. And the authoritative sites, you know, that's how I think Microsoft could get real traction around that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, agree. Okay, well, I look forward to catching up with you when you're next in this part of the world. I presume that'll be ATS in the autumn, if not before.
We have the road to ATS, though, Singapore in March.
This is true. I will see you then.
Yeah.
Super. Well, thank you, Ben. Thank you very much, Kieran, as well.
Thanks, Grace.
Thanks, Grace.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. Thanks, everyone. That was this week's MedTech Podcast.